Hello, Saver. Whether you're saving for that trip to the tropics or saving for an emergency, now is the time to take advantage of Wells Fargo's savings options. Wells Fargo offers savings accounts that can help you save towards your goals. So, what are you saving for? Visit a Wells Fargo branch or wellsfargo.com/save to open a savings account today.
Wells Fargo Bank N.A. Member FDIC.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, roughly paraphrased by Zizek, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. This podcast is sponsored by The Nation magazine and is widely available on podcasting platforms. Mathematician Chandler Davis died 2 years ago, and he was the subject of a fascinating obituary in The Nation, which I will link to in the show notes. But his significance extended far beyond the world of mathematics. He was truly a polymathic figure. Among other things, he was a science fiction writer of some note, but also a political activist. And in the early 1950s, during the Second Red Scare, his activism made him the center of a hugely important trial. Unlike other victims of McCarthyism who pled the fifth so that they could avoid giving up names of their past political associations, Chandler Davis tried a novel legal strategy of pleading the First Amendment. He said that under the First Amendment, neither the committee nor his university had the right to make inquiries into his political activism. Now, this legal gambit was not successful. Chandler Davis was not only blacklisted, but he actually served time in federal prison. But even in its defeat, the argument actually came arguably significantly close to convincing judges, and it certainly resonated with the free speech movement that predated the Second Red Scare and continues to reverberate now, of like, what does the First Amendment actually mean? The legal strategy that his lawyers carried out was influenced by the philosophy of very important legal theorist Alexander Micheljohn, who put free speech as the cornerstone of American democracy. So Davis's life, his struggles with McCarthyism, continues to resonate now, especially when a very right-wing court is using free speech for purposes completely different than anything Chandler Davis might have imagined. And that, too, is part of the story about how the contested uses of free speech. Now, Chandler Davis, because of his time in prison and blacklisting, could no longer find employment in the United States. But he ended up, after some difficulty, finding a job at the University of Toronto. And this is where my guest, the journalist Doug Bell, came in, because he got to know Chandler Davis and his wife, the very eminent historian, Natalie Zeman Davis, who herself died last year. Doug got to know them. So, and I want to bring in Doug to talk about Chandler Davis's as a man, and also the free speech struggle that he'd led, and also talk about a new biography of Chandler Davis that has just come out that has revived all these issues. So, Doug, welcome to the program.
Well, as always, Gene, a great pleasure to be here. And just to say that my background with Chandler Davis was really, as so many things in my life, through the good offices of my wife, Siobhan Roberts, who is a historian of mathematics and wrote a biography in 2006 of a guy called Donald Coxeter, who was at the University of Toronto throughout the course of his career, an important geometer. But as regards Chandler Davis, crucial to the story. When Davis was in the worst of his circumstances, which is to say, just after he'd been imprisoned for 6 months in Danbury at a federal prison, subsequently, and this is an important point, that he was blacklisted subsequent to the to his imprisonment. And the blacklisting incorporated both his dismissal from the University of Michigan under, you know, really dicey circumstances, as was the situation with the House Un-American Activities Committee. But he also applied to 150 mathematics departments across the United States. All of it fell on deaf ears. And he happened to run into Donald Coxeter, you know, this whirlywigs, the circuitous nature of reality. He happened to run into Donald Coxeter at a math conference, told him something of the story. Coxeter was predisposed, his background was as a Quaker, and he was predisposed to think that a guy like Chandler Davis was getting rooked anyway. So he immediately worked like a demon to get him into the Department of Mathematics at the University of Toronto, a department, you know, more eminent than 90% of the places he was being blacklisted by.
Before you go to the biography, so I should mention Roberts is the author of the obituary that I'll be linking to, and both the biography of Coxeter and the obituary really flesh out the sort of intersection of mathematics and politics that we're going to be discussing. But just, do you want to just say a little bit about what Chandler Davis, who I believe his friends always call Chan, what he was just like as a person?
Oh, well, I mean, just charming. I mean, there's just, I know that he was much more than that, but he had this ease and grace that was just so obvious. And both he and his wife, Natalie Zeman Davis, best known for her book, which made into the film, The Return of Martin Guerre. And so she was really an eminent historian. And they came over here during the course of the research for the book and subsequently. You know, they were over here for dinner a couple of times. And I mean, just very graceful. Graceful, highly intelligent, supremely erudite. And, you know, principled. That, I mean, now, did I gather all of that from having dinner with the guy? Probably not. But, you know, the thing is that in reading about his background, particularly the fact that he was making all of these cases for the importance of the First Amendment, having been raised by a father who himself was subject to the Red Scare, and who, in his instance, pleaded the fifth, you know, against self-incrimination because he'd been advised to do so. And so as a matter of principle, having grown up in that kind of circumstances, those kinds of circumstances, Chandler Davis, I shouldn't call him Chan because I didn't know him well enough, but Chandler Davis saw through that process to the real nut of the principle, which was that the whole HUAC enterprise was a repudiation of the very core, the very central strut of the American constitutional experiment, which is free speech.
Yes, and I should mention that Chandler Davis, his family, in addition to his father, he came from a very political family that had been involved with much activism for many generations, going back to the American Revolution, including abolitionism. So,
but he grew up with there were relatives on both sides of the Revolutionary War.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Incredible.
Yeah. So then, as you said, and I think that's actually significant to the story because he did actually try to see McCarthyism in the broader sweep of American history and the sort of American politics, to see it as like not just this one-time eruption of a demagogue, but actually something that goes to the root of what the United States actually means and what a liberal democracy actually means. Like, what is the place of free speech within a liberal democracy? And this might be a good point to bring in the philosopher Alexander Meiklejohn, who really gave this sort of philosophical, intellectual, historical grounding for Chandler Davis's bid to defeat McCarthyism through the First Amendment.
Yeah, no, it's really an intriguing story. And it's all, by the way, available in Steve Batterson's book, The Prosecution of Professor Chandler Davis, recently published by a Monthly Review Press, which is where I gathered a good portion of the Meiklejohn's involvement. So Meiklejohn had written this book around the first Red Scare, the World War circumstances, where I think the major case involved activists working to dissuade or convince people who'd already been drafted to sign documents or to devise documents that suggested that the draft was just wrong, that it was wrongheaded in its conception. And so that was what Chandler Davis' father had been involved in. But when he came to make this case to the circuit court, and then eventually through a sort of circuitous set of circumstances to the Supreme Court, it wasn't actually his case, it was another case, but very similar. The sort of central strut of this First Amendment defense was rooted in the Micklejohn's kind of philosophical observations of the importance of free speech to American life. Now, the key thing here is that amendment is not, as it's sometimes portrayed, one right among many, as established in the Constitution. I mean, there's the fifth, the people plead the fifth because that's, you have a right to not accuse yourself, essentially, self-incrimination. And then there's, property rights and all sorts of stuff is enunciated in all of the in the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments. But what Micklejohn's insight was that the entire enterprise of America, the great constitutional experiment of America, was that it was self-governing. And in order to be self-governing, all expression must be allowed, which is to say, everything must be debated, everything must be discussed. And the specific repudiation, and again, it's interesting about Chandler Davis. I mean, here's a guy, he's 27 years old. He's not even tenured, right? As an instructor, associate professor, I can't remember which, at Michigan, 27 years old. So he has this kind of insight as he's being, confronted by the FBI investigations, the HUAC, all of it, right? Which we've discussed before in this podcast, and extraordinary, right? The extent to which the great maw of the American deep state, for lack of a better term, descended on Chandler Davis. And so in the course of that, he came by way actually of seeking counsel from some lawyers, civil rights lawyers. Somebody brought Micklejohn to his attention. He took this all in. And then, of course, it absolutely jibed with his natural instinct to believe that this was the case, that as you suggested, that McCarthyism was about a lot more than just one, drunken demagogue, banging the drum up in Minnesota, right? I mean, from Minnesota. The key thing.
Actually, just a correction for all the Time of Monsters fans who are in the Great Lakes area. The Senator Joseph McCarthy was
from Wisconsin.
Wisconsin.
God.
Minnesota. Minnesota is the fine home of decent law abiding Scandinavians, unlike the rubes and rednecks of Wisconsin.
To the point, the thing is that idea that the First Amendment is not just one among many, but first, right? Really first and foundational to the entire process. In other words, all of the other rights, the ascribed rights, rely on the First Amendment in order to move forward. And this, of course, is not just a crucial insight for understanding the life and times of Chandler Davis, but also I go so far as to say that it hints at what is at stake and what is to come, or what's at stake in what has generally been referred to as the most consequential election. I mean, it seems like they say every goddamn presidential election is the most consequential election, but this coming one, Trump v. Biden, this will be and the interesting thing is it'll be wrapped up in a bunch of other issues. But really, if you look through those issues to see what the fundamental question is, it's all going to come back to what really counts as free speech.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very important point. And I want to really expand on it on a number of fronts. Let's take it a few steps at a time, because free speech, continues to remain important. And in some ways, there's been a sort of co-option of the right of Micklejohn's ideas, but used in very different ends. That is to say that the very right-wing justices who dominate the Supreme Court are using the First Amendment more and more. But they're using it to entrench various forms of reactionary power. One is corporate power to say, you know, as in the Citizens United decision, the basic premise of which is, you know, money is speech and you can't regulate dark money in elections because he who has the money has the right to make their speech known. But the other interesting innovation of the First Amendment by the right has been to use the First Amendment to defend religious bigotry. That is to say that the maker of a wedding cake is an expressive artist like Michelangelo, and therefore, if they don't want to serve gay or lesbian couples who are getting married, that's an infringement of their free speech. And there's been many other such cases where there's a kind of grounding of free speech to basically pick sides, to choose the free speech right of the religious cake maker, the homophobic cake maker, over the, you know, what one could argue is the free speech right of the gay couple to have a cake that has their names on it. So there's a kind of a weaponization of free speech by the conservative majority, making free speech actually a real cornerstone right in the Mickeljohn fashion, but in, I think, towards very opposite ends. And I know before we talked, before the podcast, we had some conversation about this, but I mean, it's worth underscoring that Mickeljohn's whole theory of speech is the opposite of the idea that money is speech, right? Like, what does he see speech for?
Yeah, and crucially so. The Citizens United case is intriguing in the sense that, for instance, Stephen Breyer, who went off the court recently, wrote both a dissent as with regards to citizens, and also wrote in a subsequent case, which I can't remember the name of, a kind of an espousal of the Mickeljohn's idea of what free speech constitutes. And what's intriguing in the subsequent decision, Breyer's, which I've read but I'm summoning from memory, is that he suggests that the influx of money into the political process as a result of citizens diminishes the overall, if you will, to free speech, or the power of free speech among all of the citizenry. And that's, you know, that's an obvious truth at one level, because, I mean, if you've got a bazillion dollars and you go and buy a bunch of ads and so forth, that gives you a big megaphone that individuals don't have, which Breyer suggested explicitly undercut the intention of the First Amendment, right? The government will in no way abridge free speech. But the sort of intriguing twist to it, I think, is, and I'm probably repeating something I said earlier, that the United States is, if nothing else, a grand experiment in self-government. And if it is, in fact, that, then the citizenry as a whole must engage in the most, the freest and the most fulsome debate that is conceivable, right? And the suppression specifically, now, this doesn't, it pertains to Breyer, but on the margin. But in the case of the McCarthy era, the suppression of an entire suite of ideas that were, you know, broadly under the rubric of the Red Scare, the communist bogeyman, the suppression of those ideas is a direct repudiation of the idea of self-government. And that, I think, is at the root of Breyer. And I have to say that the other side of this argument that's made by the right, I spent the weekend somewhat in preparation for this, somewhat as a matter of masochism, reviewing various podcasts and speechifying and so forth of Richard Posner, the very famous judge of the Seventh Circuit, famously erudite, famously prolific. Never ended up on the Supreme Court, but, you know, from the right's point of view, a kind of hero.
And it was the major innovator of what's known as law and economics, right. Which is the idea that basically judges, their job is to enforce kind of radical right-wing libertarian economic theory that is somehow implicit in the laws, although actually never was the intent of these laws.
No, absolutely. And you could argue that much of that sort of theorizing about the nature of the judge's job within the judiciary and the nature of law, there's a straight line from that to citizens. Now, what was interesting watching Posner was, so there was some debate on or debate between him and a guy called Jeffrey Stone at the University of Chicago. This is how prolific the guy was. He sat on the bench and he was a prof the whole time, essentially, at the University of Chicago. So in addition to, you know, writing 50 books and all the rest of it. But what really intrigued me was the kind of ease with which Posner dismissed concerns about communism as a threat to the United States. He said, oh, well, everybody knew, this was in the course of one of these discussions, everybody knew that communists across the United States were taking their distractions directly from Moscow. I mean, that's not an exact quote, but it's pretty close to that. And then people kind of gave him leeway because he was a kind of an elder and well thought of, although Stone kind of pushed back a little bit. And part of the whole story is that Posner's parents were communists, so he was well suited to discuss this. But that's just hooey. I mean, as a justification for the extent to which speech was suppressed, that somehow everyone who held these ideas, including Chandler Davis and others, I mean, you know, part of what got me interested in this was our discussion about Oppenheimer and Oppenheimer ratting out his associates. All of those people were just, they were intrigued by the idea. They weren't on a direct line to the Kremlin. And so the sort of the extent to which this kind of mindset has suffused and traveled through to the current situation, I found quite chilling. Because this idea that, you know, Trump keeps going on about the deep state and all the rest of it. Well, Trump grew up with the kind of crude Philistine anti-communism expressed, and I got to say it, by Posner. He grew up with that as mother's milk. I mean, he was sitting at Roy Cohn's knee, basically.
Yeah, no, Roy Cohn, I mean, yeah, to tie everything together, was Trump's major kind of mentor in his early days, and was obviously, as the listeners will remember, you know, one of the most fetid, creepy, demonic avatars of anti-communism, sleazy slimeball of the worst sort, given immortality in the famous play Angels in America. Now, as we're updating all this, like Trump's anti-immigrant minion, Stephen Miller, just said, I believe yesterday, that in the new Trump administration, one of the things that they will do is all the students who are protesting against the war in Gaza, you know, if they were like foreign students in America on a visa, well, guess what? They're going to be deported. Right. And I mean, it seems like that is in essence the McCarthyist case, right? That American citizenship is provisional. You have to pledge allegiance to a certain reactionary vision of what the nation is. And now that also includes pledging allegiance to Israel and what the Israeli state is doing in Gaza. And that if you violate that, your citizenship or your permanent residency status can be taken away. And this is part and parcel of a much larger attack on free speech on the right that, you know, one sees in like attacks on librarians and public schools, you know, that have gay and lesbian books. I think it's not too much to say that there is a kind of new McCarthyism that's brewing, and one sees the logic of it being spelled out very clearly.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to put that in a sort of constitutional context, I mean, it's not as if you confronted Stephen Miller and said, this is a repudiation of the American Constitution, what about free speech? He would, putting myself in the mind of Stephen Miller is a bit of a chore, but he would likely suggest that, as Oliver Wendell Holmes suggested in his decisions around the first Red Scare, that, and this is the crucial passage, the crucial phrase, if there is a clear and present danger to the United States, that is an immediately triggers the allowance for a suppression of speech, broadly free speech. That phrase, clear and present danger, is the crucial phrasing. And certainly, as regards the second Red Scare and the current situation, there is no clear and present danger. I mean, from people, you know, from kids going out and doing exactly what they did in the 60s, it's the same mindset, right? Hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? I mean, precisely the same set of circumstances hold. These are reasonable. Look, I'm not suggesting that there aren't, you know, people with malign intent that are mixed in with the crowd of activists, you know, supporting the Palestinians. I mean, that's perfectly plausible. But there's already every goddamn law in the book to suppress them anyway. The idea that you need to suppress free speech under the guise of this quote-unquote clear and present danger, that is the real problem. And that's the thing that Trump has no issue with.
Yeah, no,
he will always suggest that somehow America is under threat by some, you know, unseen, ghostly horror, right? That needs to be suppressed. And this is the through line from the early part of the 20th century right to now.
Well, I think that's right. And I mean, you mentioned Oliver Wendell Holmes, who I think gives the kind of liberal centrist articulation of this point of view. I would also want to mention Wilmore Kendall to actually get at more closely what the philosophy here is. Now, Kendall was a professor at Yale, a mentor to William F. Buckley Jr., who co-wrote a defense of McCarthyism that some people have argued was actually, you know, de facto written by Kendall, where he provided all the ideas and ammunition that Buckley and his brother-in-law, L. Brent Bozell, put into the book McCarthy and His Enemies. And Kendall was the major theoretician of McCarthyism. And his whole point of view was the exact opposite of Alexander Micklejohn. But to Kendall, the American democracy was not defined by free speech. He said that we have always been a people that have had the truth. We have an orthodoxy, and membership of the community involves subscription to that orthodoxy, and that if you do not subscribe to that orthodoxy, as the communists do not, you know, you deserve whatever you get. And then Kendall's, you know, famous expression of this was the true American tradition is not just the town hall where everyone holds forth. The true American tradition is running somebody out of town on a rail. He's actually describing, you know, like what he could say, really existing America has been the America of tarring and feathering, the America of lynching. And Kendall's basically saying, well, that's who we are, right? Like all the stuff that the eggheads like Micklejohn might say about the First Amendment, that's actually not what we've been about. And I think that is the philosophical position. The only other point I would add is, because we've been talking about the right, is the role of liberals in all this, because I think that is crucial. That the sort of, you know, what one can call the sort of anti-communist tradition is actually like older than communism itself. Like actually, you know, like the historians like Michael Rogan have talked about, basically conceptualized this idea of an anti-subversive tradition. This tradition of the United States would seize people who are trying to like overthrow the social order as not having rights. And the anti-subversive tradition really goes back to before the Civil War. It is the, you know, how abolitionists were kind of conceived and slaves in revolt, enslaved people who revolt. We're seeing that these are, I mean, if you look at the rhetoric of the Confederacy, they did actually use the word socialism to say, you know, these race mixers who want socialism and equality, they're not real Americans. They don't deserve free speech. And this counter-subversive tradition, and this is a crucial point, you know, which, you know, flourished before the Civil War in the attacks on abolitionism, which flourished in the First World War with the Red Scare, and in the 40s and 50s with McCarthyism, what is maybe wrongly called McCarthyism. This counter-subversive tradition flourishes best, it can really only flourish when it has is co-opted by liberals. That is, it not only just comes from the right, but has significant support from liberals. And so, like, you know, in the 20th century, it is the liberal president, Woodrow Wilson, who in the course of the First World War decides that, you know, like, that these anarchists and socialists who are saying we shouldn't be in the war, like, you know, they're troublemakers. I'm going to unleash my attorney general on them. We're going to have the Palmer raids, and we're going to deport them all. That was a liberal project. And what is called McCarthyism actually institutionally has its roots in the decision by Harry Truman to make anti-communism the cornerstone of American foreign policy. And this meant unleashing J. Edgar Hoover and HUAC, you know, which existed long before McCarthy ever came out anywhere, enlisting these forces and the loyalty oaths that Harry Truman brought in for the cause of rallying the country. You know, as one of his colleagues said, you know, we have to scare the hell out of the American people in order to get the funding that we need for the military. Because, you know, after the Second World War, a lot of Americans just wanted to demobilize. They just wanted, like, let's relax. And Harry Truman's foreign policy of NATO, of containment, could only work if you mobilize the population, which involved creating liberal anti-communism, which gave all the tools and weapons that the right needed. And in the case of Chandler Davis, to return to this, I mean, it wasn't just HUAC that was the enemy. It was all these colleges, 150 colleges, including the one that he had started off at. And those colleges were manned by liberals. And these good liberals were fully participants. They were the willing helpers and accomplices of McCarthyism. So I mean, just for the present moment. So if there is an attack on free speech, it is the liberals who are the weakest link. And if they join in, you know, which under Joe Biden, they might well do, in a sort of campaign to demonize pro-migrant voices and pro-Palestinian voices, then we are in real trouble.
Gene, that is a fantastic summation, as good as I've ever heard. I just want to add one note, which is that, you know, and it's a marginal note, but every time in the course of his, you know, with this problem that Chandler Davis came up against a liberal, for instance, I think his name was Hatcher, who was the president of the University of Michigan. The attitude is always this sort of more in sorrow than in anger. You know, there's always this attitude of, oh, I wish so much I could help, but my hands have been tied. You know, by history, by malign bureaucrats, by an unseen, right, that's never really explained, and which kind of in its own kind of gruesome, horrible way comes to pretty much the same argument as your man Kendall, right? And so, in that context, I just find it. I guess I'll just have one last quick thing to say on this, which is that this idea of counter subversion as being fundamental, a kind of ineffable is a not an ought of American life. It's the way things are. And I just want to push back against that ever so slightly in a sort of soft-headed, romantic way, which I've lately read and commend Vivian Gornick's short biography, Yale University Press, of Emma Goldman. Mm-hmm. In which Emma Goldman, who is a sort of I think generally understood by the public, at least I understood it before I'd read the biography, and there's lots in the biography that reinforce it, a sort of quintessential American subversive, right? I mean, comes from Russia, you know, devotes herself to organizing at every level a kind of counter-narrative of the American experience. And yet at the end of her life, when she'd been pitched out of the country, could never come, well, I guess she was trying to get back in, but she was actually in Toronto when she died. Like Chandler Davis. But with this very kind of extraordinary romantic, died with this feeling that America was really where the great enterprise of political life had to take place. Now, mm-hmm. You know, there was an element of just the fact of, you know, some odd million souls mm-hmm. who'd never really come to grips under quote unquote a free system of expressing themselves. Mm-hmm. But at least they didn't have the horror of the kind of feudalism and the European experience weighing them down. Goldman still held this idea that for all of America's faiblesse and failing to come to grips with the great truth of the great collective enterprise, she still felt it was the last best hope. So on that
point. Yeah,
on that.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, one should say, I was outlining Kendall's views in the spirit of a devil's advocate to have that. But I mean, the American tradition is not just, as he saw it, of lynching. The American tradition is also of slave revolts, of, union uprising, and all these great subversives who have done as much to make the country as anyone, and who are perhaps, like Chandler Davis himself, eventually apologized to and more recognized, when they're gone than when they were alive. So as we're wrapping up, I will say, to finish off my thing about liberals, I did want to, I just recalled the late Phil Oakes, the folk singer, who once had a great song called Love Me, I'm a Liberal, which I want to quote, because what you said about all the liberals who were teary-eyed about, how it's too bad, I have to blacklist you, Chandler. You're a good guy. My hands are tied. I think Phil Oakes, in that song, summed up their philosophy perfectly. Now, I'll just read the final verse. Sure, once I was young and impulsive, I wore every conceivable pin, went to every socialist meetings, learned all the old union hymns. But I've grown older and wiser. That's why I'm turning you in. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. And that is the truth, part of the true spirit of the evil that we're talking about. And that is the impulse that one has to always fight against. But with those words, I want to thank Doug for, a great conversation that has been immensely enlightening and I think resonates with so much that's going on.
Well, and thank you, Gina. And as always, I learned a lot more through the course of this.